or something like that.
Harry was suddenly far from sure that he was trying to come up with an explanation for something that had actually happened.
Actually, can you just go ahead and tell me everything you know about how the Dark Lord survived and what it might take to kill him? If he even still exists as more than Quibbler headlines.
You are not fooling me, Harry, said the old wizard. His face looked ancient now and lined by more than years. I know why you are truly asking that question. No, I do not read your mind. I do not have to. Your hesitation gives you away. You seek the secret of the Dark Lord's immortality in order to use it for yourself.
Wrong! I want the secret of the Dark Lord's immortality in order to use it for everyone! Tick, crackle,
Albus, Percival, Wulfric, Brian Dumbledore just stood there and stared at Harry with his mouth gaping open, dumbly. Harry awarded himself a tally mark for Monday, since he'd managed to blow someone's mind completely before the day was over.
"And in case it wasn't clear," said Harry, "by everyone, I mean all muggles too, not just all wizards."
"No,"
said the old wizard, shaking his head. His voice rose.
"No, no, no! This is insanity!"
said Harry.
The old wizard's face was tight with anger and worry.
"Voldemort stole the book from which he gleaned his secret. It was not there when I went to look for it. But this much I know, and this much I will tell you. His immortality was born of a ritual terrible and dark, blacker than pitchest black. And it was Myrtle, poor sweet Myrtle, who died for it. His immortality took sacrifice. It took murder."
"Well, obviously, I'm not going to popularize a method of immortality that requires killing people. That would defeat the entire point."
There was a startled pause. Slowly, the old wizard's face relaxed out of its anger, though the worry was still there.
"You would use no ritual requiring human sacrifice?"
"I don't know what you take me for, Headmaster,"
Harry said coldly, his own anger rising.
"But let's not forget that I'm the one who wants people to live, the one who wants to save everyone. You're the one who thinks death is awesome and everyone ought to die."
"I am at a loss, Harry," said the old wizard.
His feet once more began trudging across his strange office.
"I know not what to say."
He picked up a crystal ball that seemed to hold a hand in flames, looked into it with a sad expression.
"Only that I am greatly misunderstood by you. I don't want everyone to die, Harry."
"You just don't want anyone to be immortal,"
Harry said with considerable irony. It seemed that elementary logical tautologies like "all people die" equal "there are no people who don't die" were beyond the reasoning abilities of the world's most powerful wizard. The old wizard nodded.
"I am less afraid than I was, but still greatly worried for you, Harry,"
he said quietly. His hand, a little wizened by time but still strong, placed the crystal ball firmly back into its stand.
for the fear of death is a bitter thing, an illness of the soul by which people are twisted and warped. Voldemort is not the only dark wizard to go down that bleak road, though I fear he has taken it farther than any before him."
"And you think you're not afraid of death?"
Harry said, not even trying to mask the incredulity in his voice. The old wizard's face was peaceful.
"I am not perfect, Harry, but I think I have accepted my death as part of myself."
Harry said.
See, there's this little thing called cognitive dissonance, or in plainer English, sour grapes. If people were hit on the heads with truncheons once a month, and no one could do anything about it, pretty soon there'd be all sorts of philosophers pretending to be wise, as you put it, who found all sorts of amazing benefits to being hit on the head with a truncheon once a month. Like, it makes you tougher, or it makes you happier on the days when you're not getting hit with a truncheon. But if you went up to someone who wasn't getting hit, and you asked them if they wanted to start, in exchange for those amazing benefits, they'd say no. And if you didn't have to die, if you came from somewhere that no one had ever even heard of death, and I suggested to you that it would be an amazing, wonderful, great idea for people to get wrinkled and old and eventually cease to exist, why, you'd have me hauled right off to a lunatic asylum. So, why would anyone possibly think any thought so silly as that death is a good thing? Because you're afraid of it. Because you don't really want to die. And that thought hurts so much inside you that you have to rationalize it away. Do something to numb the pain so you won't have to think about it.
No, Harry,
the old wizard said. His face was gentle. His hand trailed through a light pool of water that made small musical chimes as his fingers stirred it.
No, I can understand how you must think so.
Do you want to understand the Dark Wizard?
Harry said, his voice now hard and grim.
Then look within the part of yourself that flees not from death, but from the fear of death, that finds that fear so unbearable that it will embrace death as a friend and cozy up to it, try to become one with the night so that it can think itself master of the abyss. You have taken the most terrible of all evils and called it good. With only a slight twist, that same part of yourself would murder innocence and call it friendship. If you can call death better than life, then you can twist your moral compass to point anywhere.
I think,
said Dumbledore, shaking water droplets from his hand to the sound of tiny tinkling bells,
that you understand dark wizards very well, without yet being one yourself.
It was said in perfect seriousness, and without accusation.
But your comprehension of me, I fear, is sorely lacking.
The old wizard was smiling now, and there was a gentle laughter in his voice. Harry was trying not to go any colder than he already was. From somewhere there was pouring into his mind a blazing fury of resentment at Dumbledore's condescension and all the laughter that wise old fools had ever used in place of an argument.
Funny thing, you know. I thought Draco Malfoy was going to be this impossible to talk to, and instead, in his childish innocence, he was 100 times stronger than you.
A look of puzzlement crossed the old wizard's face.
What do you mean?
I mean, Harry said, his voice biting, that Draco actually took his own beliefs seriously and processed my words instead of throwing them out the window by smiling with gentle superiority. You're so old and wise, you can't even notice anything I'm saying. Not understand, notice.
I have listened to you, Harry, said Dumbledore, looking more solemn now. But to listen is not always to agree. Disagreements aside, what is it that you think I do not comprehend?
That if you really believed in an afterlife, you'd go down to St. Mungo's and kill Neville's parents, Alice and Frank Longbottom, so they could go on to their next great adventure, instead of letting them linger here in their damaged state.
Harry barely kept himself from saying it out loud.
All right,
Harry said coldly.
I'll answer your original question, then. You asked why dark wizards are afraid of death. Pretend, Headmaster, that you really believed in souls. Pretend that anyone could verify the existence of souls at any time. Pretend that nobody cared at funerals because they knew their loved ones were still alive. Now, can you imagine destroying a soul? Ripping it to shreds so that nothing remains to go on its next great adventure. Can you imagine what a terrible thing that would be? The worst crime that had ever been committed in the history of the universe, which you would do anything to prevent from happening, even once. Because that's what death really is. The annihilation of a soul.
The old wizard was staring at him, a sad look in his eyes.
I suppose I do understand now,
he said quietly.
Oh, said Harry. Understand what?
Voldemort, said the old wizard. I understand him now at last. Because to believe that the world is truly like that, you must believe there is no justice in it, that it is woven of darkness at its core. I asked you why he became a monster, and you could give no reason. And if I could ask him, I suppose his answer would be, why not?
They stood there, gazing into each other's eyes, the old wizard in his robes, and the young boy with the lightning bolt scar on his forehead.
Tell me, Harry, said the old wizard, will you become a monster?
No,
said the boy with an iron certainty in his voice.
Why not?
Said the old wizard. The young boy stood very straight, his chin raised, high and proud, and said,
There is no justice in the laws of nature, Headmaster. No term for fairness in the equations of motion. The universe is neither evil nor good. It simply does not care. The stars don't care, or the sun, or the sky. But they don't have to. We care. There is light in the world, and it is us.
I wonder what will become of you, Harry,
said the old wizard. His voice was soft, with a strange wonder and regret in it.
It is enough to make me wish to live just to see it.
The boy bowed to him with heavy irony, and departed, and the oaken door slammed shut behind him with a thud. Chapter 40 Pretending to be Wise, Part 2 Harry, holding the teacup in the exactly correct way that Professor Quirrell had needed to demonstrate 3 times, took a small, careful sip. All the way across the long, wide table that was the centerpiece of Mary's room, Professor Quirrell took a sip from his own cup, making it look far more natural and elegant. The tea itself was something whose name Harry couldn't even pronounce, or, at least, every time Harry tried to repeat the Chinese words, Professor Quirrell had corrected him, until, finally, Harry had given up. Harry had manoeuvred himself into getting a glimpse at the bill last time, and Professor Quirrell had let him get away with it. He'd felt an impulse to drink a comma tea first. Even taking that into account, Harry had still been shocked out of his skin. And it still tasted to him like, well, tea. There was a quiet, nagging suspicion in Harry's mind that Professor Quirrell knew this and was deliberately buying ridiculously expensive tea that Harry couldn't appreciate just to mess with him. Professor Quirrell himself might not like it all that much. Maybe nobody actually liked this tea, and the only point of it was to be ridiculously expensive and make the victim feel unappreciative. In fact, maybe it was really just ordinary tea, only you asked for it in a certain code, and they put a fake gigantic price on the bill. Professor Quirrell's expression was drawn and thoughtful.
"No," Professor Quirrell said. "You should not have told the headmaster about your conversation with Lord Malfoy. Please try to think faster next time, Mr. Potter."
"I'm sorry, Professor Quirrell," Harry said meekly. "I still don't see it."
There were times when Harry felt very much like an impostor, pretending to be cunning in Professor Quirrell's presence.
"Lord Malfoy is Albus Dumbledore's opponent," said Professor Quirrell, "at least for this present time. All Britain is their chessboard, all wizards their pieces. Consider... Lord Malfoy threatened to throw away everything, abandon his game to take vengeance on you, if Mr. Malfoy was hurt. In which case, Mr. Potter?"
It took more long seconds for Harry to get it, but it was clear that Professor Quirrell wasn't going to give any more hints. Not that Harry wanted them. Then, Harry's mind finally made the connection, and he frowned.
"Dumbledore kills Draco, makes it look like I did it, and Lucius sacrifices his game against Dumbledore to get at me. That doesn't seem like the headmaster's style, Professor Quirrell."
Harry's mind flashed back to a similar warning from Draco, which had made Harry say the same thing. Professor Quirrell shrugged and sipped his tea. Harry sipped his own tea and sat in silence. The tablecloth spread over the table was in a very peaceful pattern, seeming at first like plain cloth, but if you stared at it long enough, or kept silent long enough, you started to see a faint tracery of flowers glimmering on it. The curtains of the room had changed their pattern to match, and seemed to shimmer as though in a silent breeze. Professor Quirrell was in a contemplative mood that Saturday, and so was Harry, and Mary's room, it seemed, had not neglected to notice this.
"Professor Quirrell," Harry said suddenly, "is there an afterlife?"
Harry had chosen the question carefully. Not, do you believe in an afterlife? But simply, is there an afterlife? What people really believed didn't seem to them like beliefs at all. People didn't say, I strongly believe in the sky being blue. They just said, the sky is blue. Your true inner map of the world just felt to you like the way the world was. The defense professor raised his cup to his lips again before answering. His face was thoughtful.
If there is, Mr. Potter, said Professor Quirrell, then quite a few wizards have wasted a great deal of effort in their searches for immortality.
That's not actually an answer, Harry observed.
He had learned by now to notice that sort of thing when talking to Professor Quirrell. Professor Quirrell set down his teacup with a small, high-pitched tacking sound on his saucer.
Some of those wizards were reasonably intelligent, Mr. Potter. So, you may take it that the existence of an afterlife is not obvious. I have looked into the matter myself. There have been many claims of the sort which hope and fear would be expected to produce. Among those reports whose veracity is not in doubt, there is nothing which could not be the result of mere wizardry. There are certain devices said to communicate with the dead, but these, I suspect, only project an image from the mind. The result seems indistinguishable from memory because it is memory. The alleged spirits tell no secrets they knew in life, nor could have learned after death, which are not known to the wielder.
Which is why the Resurrection Stone is not the most valuable magical artifact in the world, said Harry.
Precisely, said Professor Quirrell. Though I wouldn't say no to a chance to try it.
There was a dry, thin smile on his lips, and something colder, more distant in his eyes.
You spoke to Dumbledore of that as well, I take it.
Harry nodded. The curtains were taking on a faintly blue pattern, and a dim tracery of elaborate snowflakes now seemed to be becoming visible on the tablecloth. Professor Quirrell's voice sounded very calm.
The headmaster can be very persuasive, Mr. Potter. I hope he has not persuaded you.
Heck no, said Harry. It didn't fool me for a second.
I should hope not, said Professor Quirrell, still in that very calm tone. I would be extremely put out to discover that the headmaster had convinced you to throw away your life on some fool plot by telling you that death is the next great adventure.
I don't think the headmaster believed it himself, actually,
Harry said. He sipped his own tea again.
He asked me what I could possibly do with eternity, gave me the usual line about it being boring, and he didn't seem to see any conflict between that and his own claim to have an immortal soul. In fact, he gave me a whole long lecture about how awful it was to want immortality before he claimed to have an immortal soul. I can't quite visualize what must have been going on inside his head, but I don't think he actually had a mental model of himself continuing forever in the afterlife.
The temperature of the room seemed to be dropping.
You perceive, said a voice like ice from the other end of the table, that Dumbledore does not truly believe as he speaks. It is not that he has compromised his principles. It is that he never had them from the beginning. "Are you becoming cynical yet, Mr. Potter?"
Harry had dropped his eyes to his teacup.
"A little,"
Harry said to his possibly ultra-high-quality, perhaps ridiculously expensive, Chinese tea.
"I'm currently becoming a bit frustrated with whatever's going wrong in people's heads."
"Yes," said that icy voice. "I find it frustrating as well."
"Is there any way to get people not to do that?"
said Harry to his teacup.
"There is indeed a certain useful spell which solves the problem."
Harry looked up hopefully at that, and saw a cold, cold smile on the defense professor's face. Then Harry got it.
"I mean besides Avada Kedavra."
The defense professor laughed. Harry didn't.
"Anyway,"
Harry said hastily,
"I did think fast enough not to suggest the obvious idea about the Resurrection Stone in front of Dumbledore. Have you ever seen a stone with a line inside a circle, inside a triangle?"
The deathly chill seemed to draw back, fold into itself as the ordinary Professor Quirrell returned.
"Not that I can recall," Professor Quirrell said after a while, a thoughtful frown on his face. "That is the Resurrection Stone."
Harry set aside his teacup, then drew on his saucer the symbol he had seen on the inside of his cloak. And before Harry could take out his own wand to cast the hover charm, the saucer went floating obligingly across the table toward Professor Quirrell. Harry really wanted to learn that wandless stuff, but that, apparently, was far above his current curriculum. Professor Quirrell studied Harry's tea saucer for a moment, then shook his head, and a moment later the saucer went floating back to Harry. Harry put his teacup back on the saucer, noting absently as he did so that the symbol he'd drawn had vanished.
"If you happen to see a stone with that symbol," said Harry, "and it does talk to the afterlife, do let me know. I have a few questions for Merlin, or anyone who was around in Atlantis."
"Quite," said Professor Quirrell.
Then the defense professor lifted up his teacup again and tipped it back as though to finish the last of what was there.
"By the way, Mr. Potter, I fear we shall have to cut short today's visit to Diagon Alley. I was hoping it would, but never mind. Let it stand that there is something else I must do this afternoon."
Harry nodded and finished his own tea, then rose from his seat at the same time as Professor Quirrell.
"One last question,"
Harry said as Professor Quirrell's coat lifted itself off the coat rack and went floating toward the defense professor.
"Magic is loose in the world, and I no longer trust my guesses so much as I once did. So, in your own best guess, and without any wishful thinking, do you believe there's an afterlife?"
"If I did, Mr. Potter," said Professor Quirrell as he shrugged on his coat, "would I still be here?"
Chapter 41. Frontal Override. The biting January wind howled around the vast blank stone walls that demarcated the material bounds of the castle Hogwarts, whispering and whistling in odd pitches as it blew past closed windows and stone turrets. The most recent snow had mostly blown away, but occasional patches of melted and refrozen ice still stuck to the stone face and blazed reflected sunlight. From a distance, it must have looked like Hogwarts was blinking hundreds of eyes. A sudden gust made Draco flinch and try, impossibly, to press his body even closer to the stone, which felt like ice and smelled like ice. Some utterly pointless instinct seemed convinced that he was about to be blown off the outer wall of Hogwarts, and that the best way to prevent this was to jerk around in helpless reflex and, possibly, throw up. Draco was trying very hard not to think about the 6 stories worth of empty air underneath him, and focus, instead, on how he was going to kill Harry Potter.
"You know, Mr. Malfoy,"
said the young girl beside him in a conversational voice,
"if a seer had told me that some day I'd be hanging onto the side of a castle by my fingertips, trying not to look down or think about how loud Mum'd scream if she saw me, I wouldn't have had any idea of how it'd happen, except that it would be Harry Potter's fault."
Earlier, the two allied generals stepped together over Longbottom's body, their boots hitting the floor in almost perfect synchrony. Only a single soldier now stood between them and Harry, a Slytherin boy named Samuel Clemens, whose hand was clenched white around his wand, held upward to sustain his prismatic wall. The boy's breathing was coming rapidly, but his face showed the same cold determination that lit the eyes of his general, Harry Potter, who was standing behind the prismatic wall at the dead end of the corridor next to an open window, with his hands held mysteriously behind his back. The battle had been ridiculously difficult, for the enemy being outnumbered 2-1. It should have been easy. Dragon Army and the Sunshine Regiment had melded together easily in practice sessions. They'd fought each other long enough to know each other very well indeed. Morale was high, both armies knowing that this time they weren't just fighting to win for themselves, but fighting for a world free of traitors. Despite the surprised protests of both generals, the soldiers of the combined army had insisted on calling themselves Dramini's Sunjan Argument, and produced patches for their insignia of a smiling face wreathed in flames. But Harry's soldiers had all blackened their own insignia. It didn't look like paint, more like they'd burned that part of their uniforms, and they'd fought all through the upper levels of Hogwarts with a desperate fury. The cold rage that Draco sometimes saw in Harry had seemed to trickle down into his soldiers, and they'd fought like it hadn't been play. And Harry had emptied out his entire bag of tricks. There'd been tiny metal balls. Granger had identified them as ball bearings, on floors and staircases, rendering them impassable until cleared. Only Harry's army had already practiced coordinated hover charms, and they could fly their own people right over the obstacles they'd made. You couldn't bring devices into the game from outside, but you could transfigure anything you wanted during the game, so long as it was safe. And that just wasn't fair when you were fighting a boy raised by scientists who knew about things like ball bearings and skateboards and bungee cords. And so, it had come to this. The survivors of the Allied forces had cornered the last remnants of Harry Potter's army in a dead-end corridor. Weasley and Vincent had rushed Longbottom at the same time, moving together like they'd practiced for weeks instead of hours, and somehow Longbottom had managed to hex them both before falling himself. And now it was Draco and Granger and Padma and Samuel and Harry, and by the looks of Samuel, his prismatic wall couldn't last much longer. Draco had already levelled his wand at Harry, waiting for the prismatic wall to fall of its own accord. There was no need to waste a breaking drill hex before then. Padma levelled her own wand at Samuel. Granger levelled hers at Harry. Harry was still hiding his hands behind his back, instead of aiming his wand, and looking at them with a face that could have been carved out of ice. It might be a bluff. It probably wasn't. There was a brief, tense silence. And then Harry spoke.
"I'm the villain now," the young boy said coldly. "And if you think villains are this easy to finish off, you'd better think again. Beat me when I'm fighting seriously, and I'll stay beaten. But lose, and we'll be doing this all over again next time."
The boy brought his hands forward, and Draco saw that Harry was wearing strange gloves with a peculiar greyish material on the fingertips, and buckles that strapped the gloves tightly to his wrists. Beside Draco, the Sunshine General gasped in horror, and Draco, without even asking why, fired a breaking drill hex. Samuel staggered. He let out a scream as he staggered, but he held the wall. And if Padma or Granger fired now, they would exhaust their own forces so badly that they might just lose.
"Harry!"
shouted Granger.
"You can't be serious!"
Harry was already in motion. And as he swung out the open window, his cold voice said,
"Follow if you dare!"
The icy wind howled around them. Draco's arms were already starting to feel tired. It had developed that, yesterday, Harry had carefully demonstrated to Granger exactly how to transfigure the gloves he was currently wearing, which used something called Gecko Setai, and how the glue transfigured patches of the same material to the toes of their shoes. And Harry and Granger had, in innocent, childish play, tried climbing around the walls and ceiling a little. And that, also yesterday, Harry had supplied Granger with a grand total of exactly 2 doses of feather-falling potion to carry around in her pouch.
Just in case.
Not that Padma would have followed them anyway. She wasn't crazy. Draco carefully peeled loose his right hand, stretched it over as far as he could, and slapped it down on the stone again. Beside him, Granger did the same. They'd already swallowed the feather-falling potion. It was skirting the edges of the game rules, but the potion wouldn't be activated unless one of them actually fell, and so long as they didn't fall, they weren't using the item. Professor Quirrell was watching them, and the two of them were perfectly, completely, utterly safe. Harry Potter, on the other hand, was going to die.
"I wonder why Harry is doing this," said General Granger in a reflective tone as she slowly peeled the fingertips of one hand off the wall with an extended sticky sound.
Her hand plopped back down again almost as soon as it was lifted.
"I'll have to ask him that after I kill him."
It was amazing how much the two of them were turning out to have in common. Draco didn't really feel like talking right now, but he managed to say, through gritted teeth,
"Could be revenge for the date."
"Really?"
said Granger.
"After all this time?"
Stick plop.
"How sweet of him!" said Granger.
Stick, plop.
"I guess I'll find some truly romantic way to thank him,"
said Granger.
Stick, plop.
"What's he got against you?"
said Granger.
Stick,
plop. The icy wind howled around them. One might have thought it would feel safer to have ground under your feet again. But if that ground was a slanted roof tilted with rough slats, which had rather a lot more ice on it than the stone walls, and you were running across it at a high rate of speed, then you would be sadly mistaken.
"Luminos!"
shouted Draco.
"Luminos!"
shouted Granger.
"Luminos!"
shouted Draco.
"Luminos!"
shouted Granger. The distant figure was dodging and scrambling as it ran, and not a single shot hit. But they were gaining. Until Granger slipped. It was inevitable, in retrospect. In real life, you couldn't actually run across icy, slanted rooftops at a high rate of speed. And also, inevitably, because it happened without the slightest thought, Draco spun and grabbed for Granger's right arm, and he caught her. Only she was already too far off balance. She was falling and pulling Draco with her. It all happened so quickly. There was a hard, painful impact. Not just Draco's weight hitting the rooftop, but some of Granger's weight too, and if she had hit just a little closer to the edge, they could have made it. But instead, her body tipped again, and her legs slipped off, and her other hand grabbed frantically. And that was how Draco ended up holding onto Granger's arm in a white grip, while her other hand clenched frantically at the edge of the rooftop and the toes of Draco's shoes dug into the edge of a rooftop tile.
"Hermione!"
Harry's voice shrieked distantly.
"Draco!"
whispered Granger's voice, and Draco looked down.
That might have been a mistake. There was a lot of air underneath her.
Nothing but air. They were on the edge of a rooftop that had jutted out from the main stone wall of Hogwarts.
"He's going to come help me,"
whispered the girl.
"But first, he's going to Luminos both of us. There's no way he wouldn't. You have to let me go."
It should have been the easiest thing in the world.
She was just a mudblood.
Just a mudblood. Just a mudblood. She wouldn't even be hurt. Draco's brain wasn't listening to anything Draco was telling it right now.
"Do it!"
Hermione Granger whispered, her eyes blazing without a single trace of fear.
"Do it, Draco! Do it! You can beat him yourself! We have to win, Draco!"
There was a sound of someone running, and it was coming closer.
"Oh, be rational."
The voice in Draco's head sounded an awful lot like Harry Potter teaching lessons.
"Are you going to let your brain run your life?"
Aftermath 1. It was taking a bit of an effort for Daphne Greengrass to keep herself quiet as Millicent Bulstrode retold the story in the Slytherin Girls' Common Room, a cosy, cool place in the dungeons running beneath the Hogwarts Lake, with fish swimming past every window and couches you could lie down in if you wanted. Mostly because, in Daphne's opinion, it was a perfectly good story already without all of Millicent's improvements.
"And then what?"
gasped Flora and Hestia Carrow.
"General Granger looked up at him," Millicent said dramatically,
"and she said, 'Draco,
You've got to let go of me. Don't worry about me, Draco. I promise I'll be all right. And what do you suppose Malfoy did then?
He said never!
Shouted Charlotte Willand.
And held on even tighter!
All the listening girls, except Pansy Parkinson, nodded.
No,
said Millicent.
He dropped her, and then he jumped up and shot General Potter. The end.
There was a stunned pause.
You can't do that,
said Charlotte.
She's a mudblood,
said Pansy, sounding confused.
Of course he let go.
Well, Malfoy shouldn't have grabbed her in the first place, then,
said Charlotte.
But once he grabbed her, he had to hang on, especially in the face of approaching certain doom.
Tracy Davis, sitting next to Daphne, was nodding along in firm agreement.
I don't see why,
said Pansy.
That's because you don't have the tiniest smidgen of romance in you,
said Tracy.
Because you can't just go dropping girls. A boy he'd drop a girl like that. He'd drop anyone. He'd drop you, Pansy.
What do you mean, drop me?
Pansy said. Daphne couldn't resist any more.
You know,
Daphne said darkly,
you're eating breakfast one day at our table, and the next thing you know, Malfoy lets go of you, and you're falling off the top of Hogwarts. That's what.
Yeah,
said Charlotte.
He's a witch-dropper.
You know why Atlantis fell?
Said Tracy.
'Cause someone like Malfoy dropped it, that's why.
Daphne lowered her voice.
In fact, what if Malfoy's the one who made Hermione, I mean General Granger, slip in the first place? What if he's out to make all Muggleborns trip and fall?
You mean,
gasped Tracy.
That's right,
Daphne said dramatically.
What if Malfoy is the heir of Slytherin?
The next drop, Lord,
said Tracy, which was far too good a line for anyone to keep to themselves. So by nightfall, it was all over Hogwarts. And the next morning, it was the Quibbler's headline.
Aftermath 2.
Hermione made sure she got to their usual classroom nice and early that evening, just so that she would be by herself, in a chair, peacefully reading a book, when Harry got there. If there was any way for a door to creak open apologetically, that was how the door was creaking open. Said Harry Potter's voice. Hermione kept reading.
I'm kind of sorry. I didn't mean for you to actually fall off the roof or anything.
It had been quite an entertaining experience, in fact.
I don't have much experience apologizing. I'll fall to my knees if you want, or buy you something expensive. Oh, Hermione, I don't know how to apologize to you for this. What can I do? Just tell me.
She kept reading the book in silence. It wasn't as if she had any idea how Harry could apologize either. Right now, she was just feeling a sort of odd curiosity as to what would happen if she kept reading her book for a while. Chapter 42 Courage.
Romantic,
Hermione said.
They're both boys.
Well,
Daphne said, sounding a little shocked.
You mean muggles really do hate that? I thought that was just something the Death Eaters made up.
No,
said an older Slytherin girl Hermione didn't recognize.
It's true. They have to get married in secret. And if they're ever discovered, they get burned at the stake together. And if you're a girl who thinks it's romantic, they burn you too.
That can't be right, objected a Gryffindor girl, while Hermione was still trying to sort out what to say to that. There wouldn't be any muggle girls left. She had kept on reading quietly, and Harry Potter had kept on trying to apologize. And it had soon dawned on Hermione that Harry had realized, possibly for the first time in his life, that he'd done something annoying. And that Harry, definitely for the first time in his life, was terrified that he'd lost her as a friend. And she had started to feel, A, guilty, and B, worried about the direction Harry's increasingly desperate offers were going. But she still had no idea what sort of apology was appropriate. So she had said that the Ravenclaw girls should vote on it. And this time she wouldn't fix the outcome, though she hadn't mentioned that part, to which Harry had instantly agreed. The next day, practically every Ravenclaw girl over the age of 13 had voted to have Draco drop Harry. Hermione had felt mildly disappointed it was that simple, though it was obviously fair. Right now, however, standing just outside the great doors of the castle amid half the female population of Hogwarts, Hermione was beginning to suspect that there were things going on here that she didn't understand, and that she desperately hoped neither of her fellow generals ever heard about. You couldn't really see the details from up there, just the general fact of a sea of expectant female faces.
"You've got no idea what this is about, do you?"
said Draco, sounding amused. Harry had read a fair number of books he wasn't supposed to read, not to mention a few Quibbler headlines.
"Boy who lived gets Draco Malfoy pregnant," said Harry. "Okay, you do know what this is about," said Draco. "I thought muggles hated that."
"Only the dumb ones," said Harry. "But, aren't we, a little young?"
"Not too young for them," said Draco.
He snorted.
"Girls!"
They silently walked toward the edge of the roof.
"So, I'm doing this for revenge on you," said Draco. "But why are you doing this?"
Harry's mind made a lightning calculation, weighing the factors whether it was too soon.
"Honestly," said Harry, "because I meant to have her climb up the icy walls, but I didn't mean to have her fall off the roof. And, I kind of did feel really awful about that. I mean, I guess I actually did start seeing her as my friendly rival after a while, so this is a real apology to her, not a plot or anything."
There was a pause, then...
"Yeah," said Draco. "I understand."
Harry didn't smile. It might have been the most difficult non-smile of his life. Draco looked at the edge of the roof and made a face.
"This is going to be a lot harder to do on purpose than by accident, isn't it?"
Harry's other hand held the roof in a reflexive, terrified grip, his fingers white on the cold, cold stone. You could know with your conscious mind that you'd drunk the feather-falling potion. Knowing it with your unconscious mind was another matter entirely. It was every bit as scary as Harry had thought it might have been for Hermione, which was justice.
"Draco!"
said Harry. Controlling his voice wasn't easy, but the Ravenclaw girls had given them a script.
"You've got to let me go."
"Okay,"
said Draco, and let go of Harry's arm. Harry's other hand scrambled at the edge, and then, without any decision being made, his fingers failed, and Harry fell. There was a brief moment when Harry's stomach tried to leap up into his throat, and his body tried desperately to orient itself in the absence of any possible way to do so. There was a brief moment when Harry could feel the feather-falling potion kicking in, starting to slow him, a sort of lurching, cushioning feeling. And then, something pulled on Harry, and he accelerated downward again, faster than gravity. Harry's mouth had already opened and begun screaming, while part of his brain tried to think of something creative he could do. Part of his brain tried to calculate how much time he had left to be creative, and a tiny rump part of his brain noticed that he wasn't even going to finish the remaining time calculation before he hit the ground. Harry was desperately trying to control his hyperventilating, and it wasn't helping him to hear the shrieking of all the girls now lying in heaps on the ground and each other.
"Good heavens," said the unfamiliar man, he of the old-looking clothes and faintly scarred face, who was holding Harry in his arms. "Of all the ways I imagined we might meet again some day, I didn't expect it to be you falling out of the sky."
Harry remembered the last thing he'd seen, the falling body, and managed to gasp,
"Professor Quirrell!"
"He'll be all right after a few hours," said the unfamiliar man holding Harry. "He's just exhausted. I wouldn't have thought it possible. He must have knocked down 200 students just to make sure he got whoever was jinxing you."
Gently, the man set Harry upright on the ground, supporting him the while. Harry carefully balanced himself and nodded to the man. He let go, and Harry promptly fell over. The man helped him rise again, making sure at all times to stand between Harry and the girls now picking themselves up from the ground, his head constantly glancing in that direction.
"Harry,"
the man said quietly and very seriously,
"do you have any idea which of these girls might have wanted to kill you?"
"Not murder," said a strained voice. "Just stupidity."
This time it was the unfamiliar man who seemed to almost fall over, utter shock on his face. Professor Quirrell was already sitting up from where he'd fallen on the grass.
"Good heavens," gasped the man. "You shouldn't be. Mr. Lupin, your concerns are misplaced. No wizard, no matter how powerful, casts such a charm by strength alone. You must do it by being efficient."
Professor Quirrell didn't stand up, though.
"Thank you,"
Harry whispered, and then,
"thank you,"
to the man standing beside him as well.
"What happened?" said the man.
"I should have foreseen it myself,"
Professor Quirrell said, his voice crisp with disapproval.
"Some number of girls try to summon Mr. Potter to their own particular arms. Individually, I suppose, they all thought they were being gentle."
"Oh.
Consider it a lesson in preparedness, Mr. Potter," said Professor Quirrell. "Had I not insisted that there be more than one adult witness to this little event, and that both of us have our wands out, Mr. Lupin would not have been available to slow your fall afterward, and you would have been gravely injured."
"Sir," said the man,
Mr. Lupin, apparently,
"you should not say such things to the boy."
"Who is?"
Harry started to say.
"The only other person who was available to watch besides myself," said Professor Quirrell. "I introduce you to Remus Lupin, who is here temporarily to instruct students in the Patronus charm, though I am told that the two of you have already met."
Harry studied the man, puzzled. He should have remembered that faintly scarred face, that strange, gentle smile.
"Where did we meet?" said Harry.
"In Godric's Hollow," said the man. "I changed a number of your nappies."
Mr. Lupin's temporary office was a small stone room with a small wooden desk, and Harry couldn't see anything of what Mr. Lupin was sitting on, suggesting that it was just a small stool, just like the one in front of his desk. Harry guessed that Mr. Lupin wouldn't be at Hogwarts for long, or use this office much, and so he'd told the house elves not to waste the effort. It said something about a person that he tried not to bother house elves. Specifically, it said that he'd been sorted into Hufflepuff, since, to the best of Harry's knowledge, Hermione was the only non-Hufflepuff who worried about bothering house elves. Harry himself thought her qualms rather silly. Whoever had created house elves in the first place had been unspeakably evil, obviously. But that didn't mean Hermione was doing the right thing now by denying sentient beings the drudgery they had been shaped to enjoy.
"Please, sit down, Harry," the man said quietly.
His formal robes were of low quality, not quite tattered, but visibly worn by the passage of time in a way that simple repair charms couldn't fix. Shabby was the word that came to mind. And despite that, somehow, there was a dignity about him that couldn't have been obtained by fine and expensive robes. That wouldn't have fit with fine robes. That was the exclusive property of the shabby. Harry had heard of humility, but he'd never seen the real thing before. Only the satisfied modesty of people who thought it was part of their style and wanted you to notice. Harry took a seat on the small wooden stool in front of Mr. Lupin's short desk.
"Thank you for coming," the man said.
No, thank you for saving me," said Harry. "Let me know if you ever need something impossible done."
The man seemed to hesitate.
"Harry, may I ask a personal question?"
"You can ask, certainly," Harry said. "I have a lot of questions for you, too."
Mr. Lupin nodded. "Harry, are your step-parents treating you well?"
"My parents," Harry said. "I have four, Michael, James, Petunia, and Lily."
"Ah," said Mr. Lupin, and then, "ah," again. He seemed to blink rather hard.
That is good to hear, Harry. Dumbledore would tell none of us where you were. I was afraid he might think you ought to have wicked step-parents or some such."
Harry wasn't sure Mr. Lupin's concern had been misplaced, considering his own first encounter with Dumbledore. But it had all turned out well enough, so he said nothing.
"What about my—"
Harry searched for a word that didn't raise them higher or put them lower.
"Other parents. I want to know, well, everything."
Tall order,"
Mr. Lupin said. He wiped a hand across his forehead.
"Well, let us begin at the beginning. When you were born, James was so happy that he couldn't touch his wand without it glowing gold for a whole week. And even after that, whenever he held you, or saw Lily holding you, or just thought of you, it would happen again.
Every now and then, Harry would look at his watch and find that another 30 minutes had passed. He felt slightly bad about making Remus miss dinner, especially since Harry himself would just drop back to 7 p.m. later, but that wasn't enough to stop either of them. Finally, Harry screwed up enough courage to ask the critical question, while Remus was in the middle of an extended discourse on the wonders of James's Quidditch, that Harry couldn't find the heart to squash more directly.
"And that was when," Remus said, his eyes shining brightly, "James pulled off a triple reverse Mulligany dive with extra backspin. The whole crowd went wild. Even some of the Hufflepuffs were cheering."
"I guess you had to be there,"
Harry thought, not that being there would have helped in any way, and said,
"Mr. Lupin."
Something about Harry's voice must have reached the man because he stopped in mid-sentence.
"Was my father a bully?"
said Harry. Remus looked at Harry for a long moment.
"For a little while," Remus said. "He grew out of it soon enough. Where did you hear that?"
Harry didn't answer. He was trying to think of something true to say that would deflect suspicion, but he didn't think fast enough.
"Never mind," said Remus, and sighed. "I can guess who."
The faintly scarred face was pinched in disapproval.
"What a thing to tell."
"Did my father have any extenuating circumstances?"
Harry said.
"A poor home life, or something like that? Or was he just being naturally nasty? Cold?"
Remus's hand swept his hair back, the first nervous gesture Harry had seen from him.
"Harry," Remus said, "you can't judge your father by what he did as a young boy."
"I'm a young boy," Harry said, "and I judge myself."
Remus blinked twice at that.
"I want to know why,"
Harry said.
I want to understand, because, to me, it seems like there isn't any possible excuse for that.
A voice shaking a bit.
Please, tell me anything you know about why he did it, even if it doesn't sound nice. So I don't fall into the same trap myself, whatever it is.
It was the thing to do, if you were in Gryffindor,
Remus said slowly, reluctantly.
And I didn't think so back then. I thought it was the other way around, but it might have been Black who got James into it, really. Black wanted so much to show everyone that he was against Slytherin, you see. We all wanted to believe that blood wasn't destiny. No, Harry, said Remus. I don't know why Black went after Peter instead of running. It was as though Black was making tragedy for the sake of tragedy that day.
The man's voice was unsteady.
There was no hint, no warning. We all thought, to think that he was to be.
Remus's voice cut off.
Harry was crying. He couldn't help it. It hurt worse to hear it from Remus than anything he'd ever felt himself. Harry had lost two parents he didn't remember, knew only from stories. Remus Lupin had lost all four of his best friends in less than 24 hours, and for the loss of his last remaining one, Peter Pettigrew, there'd just been no reason at all.
Sometimes it still hurts to think of him in Azkaban,
Remus finished, his voice almost a whisper.
I am glad, Harry, that Death Eaters are not allowed visitors. It means I do not have to feel ashamed of not going.
Harry had to swallow hard several times before he could speak.
You tell me about Peter Pettigrew. He was my father's friend, and it seems that I should know, that I should remember.
Remus nodded, water glittering in his own eyes now.
I think, Harry, that if Peter had known it would end that way.
The man's voice choked up.
Peter was more afraid of the Dark Lord than any of us, and if he'd known it would end that way, I don't think he would have done it. But Peter knew the risk, Harry. He knew the risk was real, that it could happen, and yet he stayed by James and Lily's side. All through Hogwarts I used to wonder why Peter hadn't been sorted into Slytherin, or maybe Ravenclaw, because Peter so adored secrets. He couldn't resist them. He would find out things about people, things they wanted to keep hidden.
A brief wry look crossed Remus's face.
But he didn't use those secrets, Harry. He just wanted to know. And then the Dark Lord shadow fell over everything, and Peter stood by James and Lily, and put his talents to good use. And I understood why the Hat had sent him to Gryffindor.
Remus's voice was fierce now, and proud.
It's easy to stand by your friends if you're a hero like Godric, bold and strong like people think Gryffindor should be.
But if Peter was more afraid than any of us, doesn't that also make him the most brave?
It does,
Harry said. His own voice was choked to where he almost couldn't talk.
If you could, Mr. Lupin, if you have time, there's someone else who I think should hear Peter Pettigrew's story. A student in first year Hufflepuff named Neville Longbottom.
Alice and Frank's boy, said Remus, his voice turning sad. I see. It's not a happy story, Harry. But I can tell it again, if you think it will help him.
Harry nodded. A brief silence fell.
Did Black have any unfinished business with Peter Pettigrew?
Harry said.
Anything that would make him seek out Mr. Pettigrew, even if it wasn't a killing matter. Like a secret Mr. Pettigrew knew that Black wanted to know himself, or wanted to kill him to hide.
Something flickered in Remus's eyes, but the older man shook his head and said,
Not really.
That means there is something, said Harry.
That wry smile appeared again beneath the salt and pepper moustache.
You have a bit of Peter in you yourself, I see. But it's not important, Harry.
I'm a Ravenclaw. I'm not supposed to resist the temptation of secrets. And,
Harry said more seriously,
if it's worth Black getting caught, I can't help but think it might matter.
Remus looked quite uncomfortable.
I suppose I could tell you when you're older. But really, Harry, it's not important. Just something from our school days.
Harry couldn't have put his finger on exactly what tipped him off. It might have been something about the exact tone of nervousness in Remus's voice, or the way the man had said, "When you're older," that sparked the sudden leap of Harry's intuition.
"Actually," said Harry, "I think I've sort of guessed it already. Sorry."
Remus raised his eyebrows.
"Have you?"
He sounded a bit skeptical.
"They were lovers, weren't they?"
There was an awkward pause. Remus gave a slow, grave nod.
"Once," Remus said, "a long time ago. A sad affair, ending in vast tragedy. Or so it seemed to us all when we were young."
The unhappy puzzlement was plain on his face.
"But I'd thought that long since over and done, and buried beneath adult friendship. Until the day that Black killed Peter."
Chapter 43. Humanism, Part 1. The gentle sun of January shone on the cold fields outside Hogwarts. For some of the students it was a study hour, and others had been let out of class. The first years who'd signed up for it were practicing a certain spell, a spell that was most advantageously learned outdoors, beneath the bright sun and a clear blue sky, rather than within the confines of any classroom. Cookies and lemonade were also considered helpful. The early gestures of the spell were complex and precise. You twitched your wand once, twice, thrice, and four times with small tilts at exactly the right relative angles. You shifted your forefinger and thumb exactly the right distances. The Ministry thought this meant it was futile to try and teach anyone the spell below their fifth year. There had been a few known cases of younger children learning it, and this had been dismissed as genius. It might not have been a very polite way of putting it, but Harry was beginning to see why Professor Quirrell had claimed that the Ministry Committee of Curriculum would have been of greater benefit to wizardkind if they had been used as landfill. So, the gestures were complicated and delicate. That didn't stop you from learning it when you were 11. It meant you had to be extra careful and practice each part for a lot longer than usual. That was all. Most charms that could only be learned by older students were like that because they required more strength of your magic than any young student could muster. But the Patronus charm wasn't like that. It wasn't difficult because it needed too much magic. It was difficult because it took more than mere magic. It took the warm, happy feelings that you kept close in your heart, the loving memories, a different kind of strength that you didn't need for ordinary spells. Harry twitched his wand once, twice, thrice, and four times, shifted his fingers exactly the right distances.
"Good luck at school, Harry. Do you think I bought you enough books?"
"You can never have enough books. But you certainly tried. It was a really, really, really good try."
It had brought tears to his eyes the first time Harry had remembered and tried to put it into the spell. Harry brought the wand up and around and brandished it, a gesture that didn't have to be precise, only bold and defiant.
"Expecto Patronum!" cried Harry.
Nothing happened. Not a single flicker of light. When Harry looked up, Remus Lupin was still studying the wand, a rather troubled look on his faintly scarred face. Finally, Remus shook his head.
"I'm sorry, Harry," the man said quietly. "Your wand work was exactly right."
There wasn't a flicker of light anywhere else either, because all the other first years who were supposed to be practicing their Patronus charms had been glancing out of the corners of their eyes at Harry instead. The tears were threatening to come back into Harry's eyes, and they weren't happy tears. Of all the things, Harry had never expected this. There was something horribly humiliating about being informed that you weren't happy enough. What did Anthony Goldstein have inside him that Harry didn't, that made Anthony's wand shine with that bright light? Did Anthony love his own father more?
"What thought were you using to cast it?"
said Remus.
"My father,"
Harry said, his voice trembling.
"I asked him to buy me some books before I came to Hogwarts, and he did. And they were expensive. And then he asked me if they were enough."
Harry didn't try to explain about the Veris family motto.
"Take a rest before you try a different thought, Harry," said Remus.
He gestured toward where some other students were sitting on the ground, looking disappointed, or embarrassed, or regretful.
"You won't be able to cast the Patronus charm while you're feeling ashamed of not being grateful enough."
There was a gentle compassion in Mr. Lupin's voice, and for a moment, Harry felt like hitting something. Instead, Harry turned around and stalked to where the other failures were sitting. The other students, whose wand work had also been proclaimed perfect, and who were now supposed to be searching for happier thoughts. By the looks of them, they weren't making much progress.
There were many robes that were trimmed in dark blue, and a handful of red, and one lone Hufflepuff girl who was still crying. The Slytherins hadn't even bothered showing up, except for Daphne Greengrass and Tracy Davis, who were still trying to get the gestures. Harry plopped down on the cold, dead grass of winter, next to the student whose failure had surprised him the most.
"So, you couldn't do it either,"
Hermione said. She had fled the field at first, but she'd come back after that, and you had to look closely at her reddened eyes to see that she'd been crying.
Harry said. I'd probably feel a lot worse about that if you hadn't failed. You're the nicest person I know that I've ever met, Hermione. And if you also can't do it, it means I might still be good."
"I should have gone to Gryffindor,"
Hermione whispered. She blinked hard a few times, but she didn't wipe her eyes. The boy and the girl walked forward together, defiantly, not holding hands, but each drawing a kind of strength from the other's presence, something that let them ignore the whispers of their year-mates as they walked through the hallway approaching the great doors of Hogwarts. Harry hadn't been able to cast the Patronus charm, no matter what happy thought he'd tried. People hadn't seemed surprised by that, which made it even worse. Hermione hadn't been able to do it either. People had been very surprised by that, and Harry had seen her starting to get the same sidelong looks as him. The other Ravenclaws who failed weren't getting those looks, but Hermione was the Sunshine General, and her fans were treating it like she'd failed them somehow, like she'd betrayed a promise she'd never made. The two of them had gone to the library to research the Patronus charm, which was Hermione's way of dealing with distress, as it was sometimes also Harry's. Study, learn, try to understand why. The books had confirmed what the headmaster had told Harry. Often, wizards who couldn't cast the Patronus charm in practice would be able to do so in the presence of a real Dementor, going from flat failure all the way to a full corporeal Patronus. It defied all logic. The Dementor's aura of fear ought to make it harder to wield a happy thought, but that was the way it was. So, the two of them were both going to give it one last try. There was no way either of them wouldn't give it one last try. It was the day the Dementor came to Hogwarts. Earlier, Harry had untransfigured his father's rock from where it usually rested on his pinky finger in the form of a tiny diamond, and placed the huge grey stone back into his pouch, just in case Harry's magic failed entirely when he confronted the darkest of all creatures. Harry had already started to feel pessimistic, and he wasn't even in front of a Dementor yet.
"I bet you can do it and I can't," Harry said in a whisper.
"I bet that's what happens." "It felt wrong to me,"
Hermione said, her voice even quieter than his.
"I tried it this morning and I realized, when I was doing the brandishing at the end, even before I said the words, it felt wrong."
Harry didn't say anything. It felt the same thing, right from the start, though it had taken another 5 attempts, using 5 other happy thoughts before he'd been able to acknowledge it to himself. Every time he tried to brandish his wand, it had felt hollow. The spell he was trying to learn didn't fit him.
"It doesn't mean we're going to be dark wizards," said Harry. "Lots of people who can't cast the Patronus charm aren't dark wizards. Godric Gryffindor wasn't a dark wizard."
Godric had defeated dark lords, fought to protect commoners from noble houses, and muggles from wizards. He had had many fine friends and true, and lost no more than half of them in one good cause or another. He had listened to the screams of the wounded, in the armies he had raised to defend the innocent. Young wizards of courage had rallied to his calls, and he had buried them afterward. Until, finally, when his wizardry had only just begun to fail him in his old age, he had brought together the three other most powerful wizards of his era to raise Hogwarts from the bare ground. The one great accomplishment to Godric's name that wasn't about war. Any kind of war, no matter how just. It was Salazar, and not Godric, who taught the first Hogwarts class in battle magic. Godric had taught the first Hogwarts class in herbology, the magics of green-growing life. To his last day, he'd never been able to cast the Patronus charm. Godric Gryffindor had been a good man, not a happy one. Harry didn't believe in angst. He couldn't stand reading about whiny heroes. He knew a billion other people in the world would have given anything to trade places with him. And on his deathbed, Godric had told Helga, for Salazar had abandoned him and Rowena passed before, that he didn't regret any of it. And he was not warning his students not to follow in his footsteps. No one was ever to say he'd told anyone not to follow in his footsteps. If it had been the right thing for him,